Hi, folks. This Week in Law is next with Francie Rosner joining Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and me. I'm Denise Howell. Francie is the co-author of a study on web tracking going back 20 years. She's also an assistant professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington. We're going to talk about the pitched battle being waged over user control of their browsing information. Also on deck are new federal and state rules on driverless cars, ethical guidelines for robots and their owners, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 361, recorded September 23rd, 2016. We're tracking Snorlax. What's tracking you? This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/TWiL. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to BlueApron.com/TWiT. That's BlueApron.com/TWiT. And by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit TryGrasshopper.com/TWiT. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Really wonderful week. You've decided to join us. We've got a bona fide geek joining we lawyers on the show, joining us lawyers on the show. That is Francie Rosner. Francie is an assistant professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington. She also co-authored a paper recently with a great title. It's called Internet Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Tractors, an archaeological study of web tracking from 1996 to 2016. So we're clearly going to talk about that on the show and much more. Great to see you, Francie.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Also, here are my two wonderful co-hosts, Emery Roan, who is a third-year law student at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Hello, Emery. Great to see you.
Hey, Denise. It's great to see you as well. Francie, I'm super excited to hear about your report. That sounds totally fascinating, and I can't wait to dig into it.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that we have enough data to do a 20-year study of web tracking. So I'm really interested in how that all went as well, as is, I'm sure, my other co-host, Mike Keyes. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Happy Friday to everybody. Great to be here, as always.
Mike, of course, is a partner at the Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm up in Seattle, but we got to meet in Meatspace this week. That was a big treat.
It was. It was great. A lot of fun.
Yeah. Emery will have to do that soon, too. We don't have as much of an excuse as for you and I not to meet in person as Mike and the rest of us have, since he's way up in Washington. And you and I are just a bad commute down the freeway away.
But it's a really bad commute. So awful.
Really, really bad.
It can be really, really bad. All right. Well, let's get right into it. We're going to talk about one of Mike's stories on the blog he co-authors, the TMCA.com, which is the trademark copyright. What does TMCA stand for again, Mike?
Trademark, TM, copyright, C, and advertising, A.
TMCA.
It's also we like to think, kind of a clever pun on the DMCA, which of course is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So
it is all of that, and the advertising
and more.
Tie-in goes great with Francie's work as well. But let's start out talking about a copyright issue. Oh. So we were joking before the show that we know you had a good time writing this piece, Mike. It is about Beyonce. And so there are many bee puns involved, et cetera, et cetera. But it's an interesting copyright story. It is one of the most recent, if not the most recent, federal court decisions on the sans affaire doctrine, which came up on the show not too long ago when we were prepping the show and I read through your piece. This reminded me of the discussion we had not too long ago about Yolande Visser from Die Antwoord, who was not very happy with, what's the name of the movie that just came out? Suicide Squad.
Suicide Squad.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that it looked and felt a lot like their band's costuming and scenes and various things that they had done before. And that's the same kind of entanglement that Beyonce got into. Yolande Visser and friends did not sue. They just took to Instagram to rant away. But if this federal court decision is any indicator, it's probably a good thing that they didn't sue. Right, Mike?
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree with that completely. Mm-hmm. It's a interesting issue. As you noted, Denise, it really all centers around this whole concept of sans affaire, which in copyright essentially means that you can't claim copyright protection in stock scenes or stock elements or typical expression that is necessary for a particular type of art form. And I think Judge Rakoff out of the Southern District of New York did just a masterful job in going through and analyzing and applying this doctrine and giving us a really good example of how this applies, certainly in the context of a film and when scenes are similar and when they're not. So I'll tell you a little bit about the background of the dispute. So earlier this year in the spring, Beyonce, she released Lemonade, her sixth album. And in conjunction with the release of that album, as I think she has done in the past, she released wasn't quite a full length film, but it was like an hour long film that's promoting the Lemonade album. And soon after it came out, an independent movie producer, who I think is fairly successful in his own right, a gentleman by the name of Matthew Foulkes, claimed that the Lemonade promotional video infringed various scenes from his very short 7-minute film called, I think it's Palinoia. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it, but you'll see on the screen there, we have actually a clip from the court's opinion. This is one example where Foulkes said that the Beyonce Lemonade film was substantially similar. You see on the left, out of the plaintiff's film, you've got a gentleman that's distressed. He's got his head down. There appears to be some graffiti that says "Fear Not" or something to that effect. And he was claiming that this is just one example of how of the infringement that's taken place with the image on the right. You've got Beyonce also in a distressed head down position. You've got the graffiti up against a white background with black font. And in my opinion, this was probably the closest the scene with the closest similarity, although I totally agree with the court's opinion that this is simply not protectable under copyright. And what the court said is, look, the element of a character being in distress, that in and of itself is not copyrightable. So you can't claim copyright protection with characters that are in distress. And then kind of naturally flowing from that concept of a character being in distress is that the character's head is going to be down and probably leaning against something as opposed to, as the court said, dancing around. So distressed characters tend to have their heads down and buried. And so that wasn't particularly unique or original. That's something that you would necessarily need to do if you're going to have a character that's in distress. The whole treatment of these two scenes was also different. You've got a background in Matthew Foulkes' film. It looks like some sort of city background, cityscape, whereas the Beyonce film doesn't have much in the background but just a plain wall. And the courts ultimately said this, even though the characters are filmed from the left angle and they both have their heads down and there's this graffiti, those just simply aren't enough for this to be substantially similar, because you're really trying to copyright or protect a particular idea of a distressed figure as opposed to protecting a unique expression that can be protected. So there were 9 different scenes in the film that the court disposed of, that being one of them. And like I said at the outset, for those of you that are interested in looking at a very robust treatment of the sans affaire doctrine when it comes into play in the world of copyright, I highly commend this decision.
Yeah. So the takeaway seems to be that bitch stole my look is not going to be a basis to get you past through the open doors of the courthouse and on to ultimately trial. And it's worth noting that this was kicked out of court at a very early stage. There was no discovery. No trial preparation was done. This was on a motion to dismiss, which attacks the complaint on its face and says, even if you assume that everything in this complaint is true, they still don't have a claim against us. And that didn't pose any hurdle for the judge, Mike?
Not really. I mean, the judge, you know, quite candidly recognized at the outset of his opinion that substantial similarity is usually a jury question, a question of fact that ultimately needs to be decided either by a jury, if it's a jury case, or by the judge after the judge is informed of all the evidence that both sides have to offer. The court said when it comes to assessing copyrightability, especially when you're dealing with stock scenes, sans affaire, that's certainly appropriate for the court to look at and weigh in on in its own right at the outset of the case.
Right. The other thing it reminds me of is some time a while ago, I remember we were talking about the superhero 3-point stance and this doctrine, the sans affaire doctrine, and how someone was upset that I think it was Iron Man may have used something that had gone before. But again, I mean, seems like every superhero adopts that 3-point stance at some point or another, and it's just not the kind of thing that can lead to a lawsuit. So,
yeah, it's tricky. Yeah, it's these doctrines. You know, when is something substantially similar that can pose very difficult, you know, legal and factual questions for folks to answer. So I think this is just another good example of showing what's on the non-infringing side of the line when it comes to grappling with these issues.
Emery, any thoughts?
No, you know, I mean, the whole concept of sans affaire is so interesting. The complaint, it's as if they were saying that, you know, oh, well, this image of this person smiling is, you know, infringing on my copyright of this image of this person smiling. It's like, of course, if a person is sad, they're going to have their head down. They're not going to be cheery. It seems like a ridiculous complaint. I was saying in the chat, it almost sounds like a sort of intentional Streisand effect. Because I never heard of this guy's film. But yeah, I totally agree with the court. And I agree with Mike that this is probably going to wind up on some professor's lecture notes for copyright classes in class, because it's basically the textbook example. So that's good, basically good. Well, the extent of my thoughts.
We appreciate your writing it up and bringing it to our attention. Mike, let's move on and talk about the A in the TMCA blog and the wonderful paper that Francie and her fellows, colleagues at University of Washington co-authored, and get into 20 years of spelunking through the Wayback Machine with regard to ad tech. So, Francie, just seeing your paper and the fact you folks put this together and did what you did makes me think it must be really fun to do what you do at University of Washington, that you and your colleagues got together and said, let's delve deep into the Wayback Machine and invent a cool tool to allow us to do that and see what we find. Can you tell us how that all came to be?
Yeah, no, it is really fun. one of the things I really like about working in security and privacy is that it's such a broad area and it touches all aspects of technology. So it definitely keeps things interesting. So on the tracking work, web tracking and web privacy is something that we've been interested in for several years now. We had a paper on tracking back in 2012, looking just at tracking in the present at that time. And there's been a lot of interest in tracking, both from the academic research community and the media and policymakers and the public increasingly. And last year or so, when we started this project, maybe a year and a half ago, what we realized was that there had been increasing numbers of studies on tracking, but they're all different and people use different methodologies and they're looking at tracking, you know, at a particular time. The natural way to study it, of course, is to study it on the live web today. But what that doesn't really give us is a picture of how that ecosystem has changed over time, and how user privacy is impacted, how company practices have changed over time. And so that was the question, is can we get a more comprehensive view of this ecosystem and study the changes? And then the Wayback Machine, which is the Internet Archive, it's at archive.org. That's something that, you know, we're not affiliated with. That's an archive that exists and it has data reaching back to 1996. And so our question was, well, hey, can we use this existing archive of all, you know, all the popular sites on the web to actually study this question?
Did you have trouble at all with, I'm not sure what the methodology is for maintaining the Internet Archive, capturing the old websites and then keeping different copies of that site at different times so that you can track it back through time. Did you have trouble with the integrity of any of the data that you were looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So the archive is great. It has tons of data, especially for popular websites, you know, like CNN, for example. They're snapshotting that site, you know, many times a day. So it has tons of data. And there have been some prior studies looking at sort of the integrity of the archive in terms of are sites archived, you know, does their content reflect what was actually there and so on. But one of the things that was tricky for us was that we aren't interested so much in like the content of the website as you would see as a user, but we're interested in kind of the underlying technical details of the site. So in particular, when you visit a site like CNN.com, CNN is the site that as a user you've intentionally visited. It's the one that you see in your address bar. But as that your browser is loading that page, it's talking to all sorts of other entities, which we call third parties. And those are the ones that have the ability to track you. So those are advertisers or social media buttons like the Facebook like button or website analytics platforms. And to you know, a regular user of the web, those are all invisible parties. And the goal of the Internet Archive was not to necessarily archive those aspects of those pages. And so that for lots of different reasons, for a given archive of a page, even if we have the archive of kind of that top level page like CNN, there are various reasons why we might be missing some data in that kind of longer chain of requests that the browser is making. So actually, you know, initially we had the idea of using the archive and it seems like a relatively straightforward idea. One thing that makes the archive easy to use from a measurement perspective is that when you visit it and you look at a page, you know, like from 1996, your browser is still loading that page like it would load a normal page. So all of the techniques that we use to measure tracking, we can still use. So initially it seemed like it would be a straightforward process, but because the data is not always complete, you can have weird things happen where you might load a page and the archive has made some mistake in how it's put together that archive. And so you might get a page from 1996 that's showing an ad from 2004 or something like that. And so we had to understand all of these different reasons that the data might not be perfect and try to convince ourselves scientifically that the results we were seeing, like the trends of tracking increasing over time, were actually reflecting real trends and not just, you know, say because the archive got better over time at archiving pages.
Right. Well, I take it you went into it with sort of the experimental bias that you were expecting to see tracking increasing over time. That just sort of seems commonsensical that that's what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. And that is in fact what we found. And, mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons that we felt it was worth doing that was kind of confirming that intuition. I don't think we mm-hmm. or really anyone else is terribly surprised by the fact that tracking has increased. Anybody who's been using the web probably has that sense. But
do you have any scary statistics to share with our listeners about exactly the degree of how much tracking has increased, just to sort of drive that home?
Yeah. So because of the fact that the archives data isn't perfect, I would sort of any of the numbers that we have, I would take with a grain of salt. If anything, they're probably underestimates, just because we are missing some data. But for example, if we there's multiple ways that we can sort of measure how tracking has increased. One of those ways is just to look at how many trackers there are, how many entities are contacted while you're visiting pages. So what we did is we actually looked at the top 500 websites, so the most popular 500 websites from each year, because those are the websites that, you know, by definition, people most often visit. So on those 500 websites, in 2016, we see over 100 different trackers, different companies tracking, or at least appearing as third parties, compared to like one in 1996. so there's been, and that around 100 number is, like I said, it's an underestimate. If we look at data that we collect from the live web, where we don't have any of the challenges of the archive, we can see over 400 of these. So there are many, many companies that are involved in this complex ecosystem. There are other ways that we can kind of measure how tracking has increased. Another is if you look at an individual site, like on average, how many trackers do these different sites include? And that's also increased. Mm-hmm. So back in 1996, you know, most sites didn't have trackers on them. Now most sites, like 75% of sites we found, have at least one third party on them. And on average, they include multiple of them. So on average, they include about four. And then the final thing that we look at is not, you know, those are kind of like how much is this going on? But from a privacy perspective, what you're really interested in is for the most popular trackers, how much can they see of my browsing history? Mm-hmm. So if I visit, you know, CNN.com and then I visit the New York Times and the same tracker is present on both of those sites, then that tracker can kind of link that together and say, you know, this user might not know my name, but at least know that I'm the same user. This user has visited both of those sites. And so the question is, how big is this browsing profile that the trackers can create of you? And so if we look at who are the most popular trackers, they appear on upwards of 30 or 40% of the top 500 sites in 2016, whereas in 1996, that just wasn't the case. There was the occasional third party here and there that was probably not intentionally tracking in the way that these companies make it their business model today. So, yeah, we've really seen a dramatic increase in the last 20 years, even in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Have you seen, two, you mentioned the four most popular trackers. Can you list for us who they are? And have you seen sort of a consolidation, even though there are many, many more trackers today than there were 20 years ago? Is there a long tail happening here where there's a dominant group and then it kind of tails off?
Yeah, absolutely. So the most popular trackers are probably the ones that you would expect, like domains owned by Google. DoubleClick is Google's ad network, I think, is the most popular ad network. Actually, the most popular single tracker that we see is Google Analytics, although that's actually an interesting case because Google Analytics is designed as an analytics service for website owners so they can, you know, see how people are using their sites. And actually the way that it's designed technically is subtly different from how DoubleClick and other ad networks work. So it's not clear that Google Analytics is actually creating this cross-site profile of where you're browsing rather than just giving statistics on individual sites. One of the other things that often gets lost a little bit is that men, you know, there's different techniques that these trackers use and they have different capabilities. So certainly the most popular third parties that we see or the most popular mechanism we see is what we would kind of consider standard ad tracking. But there are other things we see as well.
Okay. Tell us about the tool that you built to delve into the Wayback Machine.
So this is a tool that we call Tracking Excavator, and that we sort of think of this as web archaeology, which is where the title of the paper comes from. And what this tool does, it's actually built on a previous tool that we had created that automatically detects tracking behaviors on websites. Previously, we had used that live web, and in this project, we adapted it to study tracking in the Wayback Machine. So much of that adaptation was dealing with some of the nuances of the Wayback Machine. But fundamentally, what the tool does is it looks for technical mechanisms associated with tracking. So, for example, the most common one is a browser cookie. So trackers will, when they're loaded by your browser, they'll set a cookie, which is essentially just a small text file in your browser. That text file will include some kind of unique identifier, like a long string of numbers. And by seeing that identifier over and over again, that's how trackers will create this browsing profile of you. So these are the kinds of things that our tool looks for and then automatically classifies domains like DoubleClick as potential trackers.
Sounds like it's a multi-purpose tool. Potentially, you could tweak it into being a really effective ad blocker if you wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. So you could certainly take the output of the tool and then block those domains. And that's actually not too different from how some other tools work. So there is a whole bunch. If you're hearing this and you're like, ah, crap, I never want to browse the web again because now I'm freaked out. There are tools, browser extensions usually that you can install that will help with this to some extent. And this is how some of them work, trying to automatically detect tracking behaviors.
And so for our listeners, we're talking Privacy Badger, Ghostery, any others that we should be keeping
an eye on? So Privacy Badger is one. Privacy Badger is from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and it tries to automatically detect tracking behaviors. It actually runs some code that I worked on with them based on a previous project. I can talk about that more too. But yeah, Ghostery is another one. Ghostery uses a blacklist of pre-compiled tracking domains. There's kind of pros and cons of those approaches. There are also tools that are explicitly ad blockers. Those are sometimes, and in fact often, also have a tracker blocking effect, but they have a subtly different purpose. There's Disconnect, there's uBlock Origin. Those are a few that come to mind, but there's a whole bunch of them, and they all, I would say, unfortunately, none of them are perfect, but they will all sort of reduce your tracking footprint.
One of the things your study found is not just that trackers have increased and proliferated, but their behavior has changed. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, so the kind of most basic form of tracking is this cookie-based tracking that I just described. But back in 2011 or so, when we first started looking into the tracking ecosystem, we realized that it's actually much more complicated than that, and many trackers use additional techniques. So, for example, one thing that we see often is that trackers will kind of refer to each other. So the way that it works in the basic case is that the website like CNN will say, okay, I want to put an ad here, and they'll include essentially one tracker. But that tracker might then contact a bunch of other third parties because it might be doing like an ad auction or something like that. So we'll see this proliferation of third parties that are loaded on a given page. And that's part of what explains, you might see upwards of 30 third parties that load in addition to the web page that you're trying to actually visit. And that this kind of referred tracking explains how those numbers balloon so much. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you're ever noticing at the bottom of your browser a whole bunch of stuff loading after you've loaded the web page, I believe that's what Francie's talking about. And it's not exactly great from a, it's not great from a privacy standpoint, but it's not great from a performance standpoint either. It really can slow down the site.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's, I think there may be some benefit to having tracking blocking tools also to performance. There can also be a negative effect. So of course the, you know, trackers are not, we're talking about them from a privacy perspective here, but they're often providing useful features. So, you know, you might say, well, if I'm seeing ads, I might prefer to see targeted personalized ads rather than things I don't care about. So, another type of tracking I was going to mention that I find particularly interesting is what we call personal trackers. And these are things like the Facebook like button or the Twitter tweet button, things like that. And the reason they're interesting is that, what you might not realize when you load a web page that has the like button on it is that Facebook is actually being contacted by your browser just to load that button. You don't have to click on the button for Facebook to learn that you visited that page. And I think that's uncomfortable from a privacy perspective for many people. But on the other hand, it might also be useful. You know, it might tell you how many of your friends have personalized information, like how many of your friends have liked this page, let you like the page and share it to Facebook. So, you know, they're not all bad. They have useful features that people might like. And so blocking them can also remove those features.
And then there's the whole, I mean, you know, this debate has been going on forever, but, you know, the argument that like using ad blockers or, you know, is somehow stealing or taking, it is definitely like taking revenue from the website creators, and the idea that, you know, yes, these trackers sort of have enabled the web as we, you know, have come to expect it today. It's a really interesting sort of delicate issue, I think, about, you know, what exactly are we leaving behind and how does that shape what the internet is right now? You know, I think that Cory Doctorow, not to jump topics, but Cory Doctorow had a great article that we have in the show notes about, you know, the privacy wars are going to get a whole lot worse. And he talks about that too, you know, the idea that down the line you're going to be able to do archaeology on all of our cookies and tracking information, which is sort of what you guys are doing, except looking at the specifically archiving out, you know, the data that they have on us, not just the presence of cookies, but what the cookies have sort of scooped up. I don't know how to take that, but it's just very creepy.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I mean, one of the things that's hard about working in this space is that it's not clear what the solution is. I mean, one of the reasons that I'm concerned about tracking and privacy is that people often don't know that it's going on. You know, when you're loading a web page, you went to CNN, just to use that example again, you didn't intentionally visit all of these other third parties, and you might not even realize what they are. So kind of that lack of user awareness and control over where information is going is concerning to me. And the fact that, you know, as we keep doing this, we use computers and more things, everything is now connected, that all this information is being collected about us. And even if we're not so concerned about, you know, maybe we're not concerned about Google, you know, we have Google accounts and, you know, maybe we trust Google, but we can't anticipate, you know, if there are ever data breaches or how data might be used in the future, what kinds of, you know, machine learning magic can be applied to learn things about us that we didn't intend to share. And so I think it's an important conversation to have, but you're absolutely right that it underpins the economic model of the internet as well. And so I don't have a good solution for how to walk that line.
Yeah, there are a ton of issues for us to sort of chew on, and hopefully lawmakers and regulators to chew on as well from the policy standpoint about all this. As lawyers, I highly commend you to read the article that Emery mentioned by Cory Doctorow at Locus Online, who not only you sort of tease up those issues by pointing out that all of this sort of takes place legally because we've all quote unquote agreed to terms of service and privacy policies that allow this behavior to take place. There are courts who from time to time chuff at that and say, you know, you can't really call these legitimate meeting of the minds kinds of agreements. And
not enough courts, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. And at the flip side of that is the web grinds to a screeching halt if we do not have enforceable online agreements. But there has to be, it's the consent piece that has to be legitimate. And that's where the tension is so fraught.
I think that it's not just the consent, it's the notice and consent. And I think mm-hmm. the leave out notice, I think, is, you know, unfairly placing the blame sort of on the end users. You know, like if the consent issue is, you know, yeah, you've sort of consented, but there's the way that we've been given notice of these practices is just, you know, ridiculous. Like, of course, you know, lots of people have written about how impossible to read, how impossible to use, you know, privacy policies and EULAs are. But yeah, you know, absolutely. As we continue into the world of the Internet of Things, and, you know, as we continue into the world of like smart contracts, we're just going to be dealing with thousands of, you know, impossible to deal with EULAs every day. And right. the idea that we could be consenting to anything is just ridiculous. And I think that if we want the internet to not grind to a halt, the thing that really needs to be improved is how the notice is given. Because if notice was better, if people were actually made aware of this is actually concretely what is happening with your data concretely, you know exactly what we're doing, then maybe there would be more pressure, more people would push back against the idea that they're consenting at all.
And there are policy folks and geeks out there who are working on ways that the data that is used is the fuel that drives this engine is somehow placed more in under the user's control, and they get to decide individually who gets it. VRM movement and others out there are what comes to mind, but again, they're not. It's nothing that's mainstream yet. What I love about Corey's piece here, and you can see this in everything else that we're discussing today at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're in episode 360 today. I love how he gives the history of it's sort of a good companion piece to your study, Francie, of how web tracking, how and when it got started and what it looked like in the early days. We're episode 361 today. I didn't update that in our rundown. I will do that. Where was I? So he gives this nice historical background. And then, you know, as he has this amazing ability to do, we talked about when we were talking about smart contracts, we pulled out a piece from his Eastern Standard tribe that this was years ago that envisioned how these things were going to work pretty concisely. Here's what he writes about where this is going, not just from the personal standpoint, personal privacy standpoint, but the corporate liability standpoint. Eventually, some lawyer is going to convince a judge that, say, 1% of the victims of a deep-pocketed company's breach will end up losing their houses to identity thieves as a result of the data that the company has leaked, and that the damages should be equal to 1% of all the property owned by a 53 million or 500 million customers who the company has wronged. It will take down a Fortune 100 company and transfer billions from investors and insurers to lawyers and their clients. When that day comes, there will be blood in the boardroom. Every major investor will want to know that the company is insured for a potential award of 500 times the company's net worth. Every reinsurer and the underwriter will want to know exactly what data collection practices they're insuring against. Indeed, even a good scare will likely bring both circumstances to reality, even if the decision is successfully appealed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's not just looking at how dystopian this is for individuals, but how untenable it is for the economy. Because, you know, at some point, I would venture to say that the circumstances he's describing are going to come to pass, that people are and their lawyers are going to get so freaked out and the breach will be so egregious that something like this could happen. Mike,
I don't know. At the same time, we've had judges say that EULAs are perfectly fine so far multiple times. And people said that arbitration clauses are okay, even though it's mm-hmm. Ridiculous that to assume that people could be, I'm not so confident. I hope. Yeah. I think,
healthy skepticism.
But yeah.
Yeah.
I hope so.
So, Mike, here's where the A and TMCA comes in on a couple of fronts. Number one, on this sort of like 10,000 foot looking into the future level, where it's a huge corporate liability issue if they're not careful, not just in the management of the data, but in the practices they decide to adopt strategically as a company. But also in the much more short term, the ad wars that we see going on right now as we sit here today, where there are tools available, like we've mentioned on the show, Privacy Badger and others, attempting to block ads, and people on the advertising side very, very intent on their ads getting through. So we see this sort of one-upsmanship on the tech side as people try and block, and then people try to make unblockable ads. Where do you see all that going, Mike?
Gosh, I wish I had a crystal ball. I thought your comment that you were reading from the article was quite apropos in light of the news today that we heard about the massive data breach at Yahoo. What was it, like 500 million? What was the figure, Emery? Was it like
500 million?
Million?
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest data breach in the history of the world, isn't that right?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, it's pretty massive. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. I don't have any answers, certainly any better than anybody else does. But wow. You know, we'll just
apparently
have to,
biggest ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, one other thing about the Yahoo data is that it's worth pointing out that it's an email account for many people, and email accounts are the accounts that are often your gatekeeper account. So you reset all of your other accounts through your email account. So you know, in some sense, that is your most valuable account. So if you have not changed your password, you should do that. And if you use an email provider that supports two-factor authentication, that's worth doing, because that is the account that holds the keys to your others.
All right. Well, this is really fascinating. We don't have many answers. We know that it's an important issue, and one that I'm sure is near and dear to all of your hearts, since none of us want personally identifiable dossiers created about our online activities, such that we would wind up as the plaintiff in the lawsuit that Cory Doctorow describes. We're going to get around to, in just a moment, talking about the Amazon Echo and the considerations you might want to have in your mind when you invite people over in your Echo's presence. But before we get to that, we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Braintree, code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. I hope you are. Then why wouldn't you use the same simple payment solution that helped those companies become what they are today, or those organizations? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree is going to support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. You'll see fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/12. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. Before we leave the topic of ad tracking, I just wondered, Francie, if you had seen this sort of one-upsmanship and technology playing out in any of the data that your study looked at. Could you tell sort of when ad blockers began to become, I wouldn't even say they're widely used today, but began to be used? And could you detect responses or shifts in strategy because of that?
That's a really good question. Not so much on the ad blockers, although I think there is something happening now. I feel like just in the last year, I've noticed more and more sites that will not let you access the content if they detect you have an ad blocker. So it seems like there's something happening there. In terms of, I mean, we certainly see some of that type of adaptive behavior in the data, not for ad blockers in particular, but you know, in part just because the techniques are evolving. I think my intuition is that the number of people who are actively blocking tracking is still so low that the need to circumvent that is not that high, although the latest ad blocking changes might be affecting that. But for example, one of the things that we have seen emerge over the last few years or so is tracking techniques that don't rely on storing information in the browser. So cookies are something that are stored in your browser that you can block and you can delete. However, trackers can also use what we call fingerprinting techniques to re-identify you. It turns out that the combination of attributes about your browser and your machine, like which browser you're using, your screen resolution, your operating system, sort of hardware quirks, essentially, all these different things can combine to create an essentially unique fingerprint of you that trackers can use without having to store any information in your browser. And as sort of browsers themselves have become more sophisticated and supported more APIs for these types of things and more ways of storing data other than cookies in the browser, we have seen an increase in use of these kind of alternate, you know, non-cookie-based tracking mechanisms. Though I don't know how much of that is directly in response to people blocking cookies, which I suspect is a minority of users, and how much is just that the technology has been improving.
Were you able to determine anything about companies' abilities to identify users across devices? So from your phone to your browser at home to your browser at work, is there a unitary profile that can be constructed of you just based on, say, what browser you're using?
Yeah, so not from that data, but certainly that is possible, and that is something that I think is desirable for these companies. I mean, one simple way to do it is for the trackers that we call personal trackers. Those are ones that you've often logged into the account for, like Facebook. So there it's pretty clear how they could track you across devices. I think that you know, there are also other techniques to do that, like maybe through these referred trackers and so on. But I think this is one of maybe the holy grails of tracking, is to try to track you as an individual rather than just as a device.
Right. Anybody, any further thoughts or ideas or questions for Francie before we move on?
I mean, I guess this is, you know, asking for the solution, but you know, just from your perspective, what are advertisers to do? What are web creator? What is the internet to do? What is the correct way of handling this in the future? Do you see a way of sort of backing out of this situation we found ourselves in, where you know, the entire of, you know, basically everything we think of as the free web is supported by these types of really pervasive profile building, fingerprinting, tracking across everything?
It's a really good question, and unfortunately I don't have a great answer. I think there's a combination of, you know, some of the issues that you've been talking about in terms of notice and consent, you know, people having more control over how their data is collected and how their data is used. It's a hard problem because communicating with users, you know, you can't ask users to make decisions about like every single web request their browser is making. That would be ridiculous. But some combination of user-facing tools that increase awareness and control, and potentially something on the policy side as well in terms of how data is treated, how long data is retained. You know, it's not clear maybe that this data needs to be kept forever, as well as how it's used in terms of targeting and for other purposes. But I think it's really challenging. And one of the reasons that we do the types of studies that we do is to kind of keep an eye on what the ecosystem is, so that when we have these conversations, we at least know what's going on.
And on the digital archiving side, is there a
body of data that is being created that is publicly accessible right now that could be trawled later that could contain personally identifiable information? Or, you know, could we expand your study 15 years from now and actually look into the kinds of breadcrumbs that are being left around by us individuals and not just by the sort of systems that are being set in place?
That's a really good question. Not that I know of exactly. But I mean, this is, for example, one of the limitations of our study is that the archive snapshot sites, you know, from sort of a neutral perspective, and that snapshot right. is what you've got. And so you don't know what does the web look like to somebody who's logged into Facebook or Google or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's a view we don't have. So as far as I know, no, but, and it's tricky, right, because of personal information, but it's a very good question.
So I'd like to see a open source Firefox add-on or Chrome plugin that lets you sort of collect that data and strip out your identifiable features of it and maybe use that, collect that data so that we can build a study like that in 10 years from now. So get on that comp site, kids.
It's right. challenging, actually, because anonymization is hard. So even if you just strip out right. you know, the identifying information, chances are the websites that you visit will still identify you. So
right.
Yeah,
I remember reading
a hard problem.
About a plugin, and I remember using it for a while, that it didn't try to block the fingerprinting as much as it just lied about your computer, where it just said, like, oh, I'm not actually using a Firefox machine, or like it randomly changes that each time you start up. Is that a technical solution to this, or is that even has fingerprinting gotten too intelligent for that?
I think so. It is definitely one possible solution. It's not perfect. One of the challenges with fingerprinting is that it's using features of the browser that are intended, you know, they're not there for tracking. They're there for other purposes.
Right.
Like the website wants to show you the appropriate version of the site for your screen resolution or something. So you could probably have some side effects, but yeah, I mean, I think kind of, lying about your fingerprint is one viable technical strategy. There are some things that you might not be able to lie about. Like some of the fingerprinting techniques are based on things you might not be able to change, like, specifically how your hardware draws things. And those are kind of physical differences that are hard to change, but there are, you know, you can make yourself less identifiable, I think.
Before we conclude this conversation, I'm just wondering if any of you think that based on the considerations we're talking about and the fact that everyone's creeped out at some level about being tracked, just anecdotally, I mean, everyone's had that experience where something they've looked at online and then haven't given another thought to follows them around because they didn't buy it. And you can't escape it at that point. You know, if you don't have sufficient ad blocking on, you're going to see that product put in front of you saying, really, you know, you didn't actually want to pick this up. And that's just one example of the creepy nature of tracking. Does anyone think that there could be, or does anyone know why there isn't a more viable market for a browser that markets itself as the privacy browser, that has ad blocking built in, that has some sort of digital shredding technology that's going to make sure that there is no, you know, Oort cloud of all your data that can be mined later down the road? Emery, why do you think that that sort of consumer focused product doesn't exist, or if it exists, hasn't taken off?
Well, I think that, I mean, DuckDuckGo certainly has their own sort of privacy directed apps. Mm-hmm. There's obviously like Tor and the Onion browser. But you know, you tell people to use DuckDuckGo and they complain that it's not as good as Google because Google knows exactly what they want before they type it in the bar. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes back to what Francie was saying earlier, that a lot of these trackers, yeah, it creeps us out, but there is utility to them that people sort of take for granted, I think. You know, mm-hmm. I personally run on a VPN basically all the time, except when I'm on Twill, because for some reason I can't use the Twitch chat in VPN. Guys, come on, get on that. but, you know, I use VPN. I use, try to cover my steps. I, you know, use all the Disconnect and uBlock Origin and Privacy Badger. But yeah, there's I don't know. There's a limit of what you can do. I think a lot of it feels like, you know, you're shouting into the wind, because as much as you're even when I'm doing all of that, it's like, well, I've got three different Google accounts because of my Twit work or my intern work or my school work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very difficult to live without these kind of trackers, even when you're consciously trying to avoid them.
Right. Faux pas you can points run, out in IRC. Can't. Sorry. Oh. I just wanted to mention that you can even have items follow you around after you've bought them, which is even more useless. What were you going to say, Mike?
I was just going to say to Emery, you can run, but you can't hide, right? I mean, no matter what you do. So
I don't know. It definitely feels like an uphill battle a lot of times.
Hey, Mike, we know you have to run and give a talk this afternoon. We're very happy that you've been able to join us. We'll see you next week. Anything else you want to let us know about before you head out?
No, I'm just heading over to Gonzaga Law School to present at a CLE, the year in copyright. So I'm excited to go do that. Mm-hmm. But great to be with you all. And Franzi, thanks so much for being with us today. Fascinating. Loved reading your article.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Take care, Mike. We'll see you next week.
Take care, all.
All right. Let's talk about Amazon. I'm not sure. Are we calling it Echo or Alexa these days? I'm confused. There's one in my kitchen.
Just make sure to clearly say, hello, Alexa, into your microphone. I'm sorry, listeners. That was awful. I'm really sorry.
Yes. Whatever we're calling it these days, lots of people have them in their homes. More and more people will have different iterations of them in their homes with the little dot that they've come out with, the Echo Dot. It's expanding into Europe, and it's not the only product that listens to and logs conversations around it in order for it to be effective. So there's a great piece at Christian Science Monitor that's headlined, "When Alexa is listening, what do you tell house guests? You know, what sort of ethical or legal, maybe eventually someday, obligation might be on you?" Or it might be on the companies, get back to Emery's notice piece, the companies that are making these products to be able to advise people when they're in the vicinity of being recorded that they're being recorded. Again, it doesn't really come up with answers, but it raises the point that, and I've certainly had people come into my home and say, oh, you've got an Echo. So everything we're saying is being recorded right now. They're aware of it. So I haven't had to warn them, but there might be situations in which you would have to do that. Are we moving to that world, Emery?
I'm sorry. I was actually in the chat. I punt that to Francie. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I was asking you how close you think we are to sort of a duty to warn. But much along the lines of, say, you have some hazard in your house that could injure someone, you would need to tell them about that potentially or open yourself up to liability. Do you think we're moving toward a world where there would be a duty to warn about your various devices that are listening and recording?
You know, I don't know if there's if we're moving towards a world where there's a legal duty to warn, at least not until we see some kind of, you know, really gruesome case come up at you know, facts I can't really imagine right now. But mm-hmm. I do think it's really fascinating to sort of consciously think about and discuss the role that etiquette plays as we invite these listening devices into our house, into our homes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that, like, yeah, our social norms are just going to have to sort of very rapidly adapt to the idea that these things are listening to us. And yeah, some people might not be okay with that. And I think that there are very good reasons why they might not be okay with that. But yeah, you know, on going back to like the duty to warn, I remember we were talking about, you know, the idea that Alexa is, you know, listening to children, recording their voices when they're interfacing with Alexa, you know, that might be the sort of, you know, legal requirement or legal restrictions that come up against these kind of companies. But yeah, it's, the idea that the article put forward that, you know, when you have someone in, you might want to tell them, oh, by the way, this device is listening. I can turn this off if you don't want it to. In an ideal world, I certainly would hope that people would start doing that. But I don't know if I see it happening.
Right. And I don't know. Much more, I would want to wrap my head around COPPA and its requirements in this context in a little more depth before weighing in on whether I think something like Alexa or the Barbie doll, the talking Barbie doll that records and stores conversations with children. You know, I don't think lawmakers were envisioning those kinds of products when they wrote the Child Online Privacy Protection Act. They were envisioning collecting data on the web in the way we've been discussing for most of the show. But when you move to a device that is performing that function and using the internet to do it, you know, is it the same? Does it come under our existing laws? Or do we need something new? I'm not quite sure.
Or what about, you know, the wiretap
laws? I'm ready to
laws,
answer that question.
You know? there's the same thing with the wiretap laws. You know, the idea that you know, we're in a two-party consent system in California.
Right.
You know, what does that mean when maybe your television is actually, you know, surreptitiously recording, but only because that's, you know, a feature, not a bug? You know, I don't know. It's an interesting world we're coming into.
Right. And there's the added piece, too, that it's not... It's your device and the company that made the device that is recording and logging that data, and not you personally. So it would be some sort of maybe secondary or vicarious liability for the individual.
The Echo really interesting, though, actually, because there, you know, one question is, who are you concerned about having access to the recording? There's Amazon, or there's any of the apps that are running, there's, you know, somebody who might access the data Amazon has. But there's also the other users of the device. So one thing that's interesting, I also have an Echo, you know, despite my privacy reservations.
Sure.
And so we have two accounts linked to the Echo, and we in the Echo app on our phones, you can play the things that have been said to it, I guess, you know, for various reasons, including to see that it didn't actually understand what you said and do some debugging. It screws with your mental model and your expectation of what it means to be talking inside your home. Like the fact that I can open the app and, you know, play a recording of my husband talking to Alexa, you know, even if that doesn't contain private information, it kind of leads to this chilling effect in which you, and I think relates to this etiquette question, in which you are uncomfortable, in your own home with what you say, because that might end up recorded in the app that, you know, your spouse or your housemate or roommate can play.
Right.
And similarly, you mentioned the Hello Barbie. That's actually got a similar kind of situation where parents can go into the website and listen to the recordings of the child talking with the Barbie, and even share them on social media, which seems like a cute... Yeah, exactly. It seems like a cute idea, but also just, you know, it violates what I assume are the expectations of the kids playing with this toy, you know.
You say cute. I think you mispronounced terrifying there. I'm sorry.
Exactly. We discussed a lawsuit last week in Europe where an 18-year-old was suing over the photos that had been her parents had posted of her throughout her life. So you can just imagine if you expanded into the worlds of your conversations with Barbie. I definitely think this is a moving target, as are I put the story of the exploding Samsung phone into our rundown for today, even though there's very little privacy overlay to that, except that it is a Samsung phone that had this issue. And Samsung is also the company making the refrigerator that happens to be in my kitchen and other devices, I assume, as well, that to which you can connect things like your Google account and your Twitter account, and et cetera, and then, you know, it's been shown to not be terribly secure in the way it's communicating the login data back and forth, et cetera, for those accounts. So, do we really want the company that makes the exploding phone also making our net connected fridges? And what sort of safeguards do we need in place to make sure that the privacy piece is taken care of? I don't actually
have
answers.
This is also the same company that had the smart TV that was listening to your conversations and then sending them in the clear, unencrypted back home so they could be transcribed. And, you know, they've already sort of run afoul of some privacy issues before.
Yes. I believe this story we have.
But, you know, I do want to say that on the idea of how far are we going to have to go before we see some sort of, you know, liability for the companies, like what is the privacy example of a battery exploding and lighting your Jeep on fire. You know, like, what? How far do we have to go before we get to the equivalent where, you know, people where the courts recognize that this is insane? Because, yeah, you know, it's gotten to the point where clearly we're okay saying, well, you know what, if your battery's going to light on fire, you probably shouldn't be allowed to take it on an airplane. But, you know, we're not at all in the same situation where, well, if, you know, the devices carrying in your pocket and in your house can listen to every single thing that you're saying and, you know, record that information, and there's really little control over what data, what's done with that data, somehow those things aren't seen as analogous, or at least as damaging as I think they are. So,
right. Mac Daily News is the story we have in our discussion points on the exploding Samsung phone. And their take is, it's sad that it takes an explosive fire and deep burns to the flesh for some to realize that it's not an iPhone. It's an incendiary device for your pocket, cobbled together by a South Korean dishwasher maker.
Oh, that's a little rough. Samsung makes some good stuff too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I have the fridge functions well. I'm just not real. My son was asking me the other day, why do we have a smart fridge exactly? And I told him, because I am interested in these things. I'm interested in what it does and doesn't do. And we talk about these things on my show. So, you know, I guess I'm the canary in the coal mine, or one of them.
But yeah.
It's fascinating stuff. One final privacy story to discuss, and that's just a follow-up, a footnote to going back to the Riverside shooting incident earlier this year and the huge kerfuffle about whether whether Apple had to cooperate with the FBI in unlocking the suspect's phone. There has been a lawsuit filed over all of that now in federal court in Washington. It seeks the details about the FBI's contract with the vendor that it still hasn't identified that it retained to unlock the phone so that it didn't have to use uncooperative Apple to do so. The plaintiffs are Gannett Company and Vice Media and the Associated Press. And so they want to know who that vendor was and various other information about that whole process. So a Freedom of Information Act kind of pursuit here. And if you're interested in who that was, you might want to follow that case. Any thoughts on that, Emery?
No, I don't really have any thoughts on it. I think that anyone that was paying attention sort of figured there'd be a FOIA case brought up again eventually. Definitely something to keep our eyes on, figure out, you know, exactly how much money was spent on this. And, you know, keep it in mind for next time.
Right. Okay, we're going to talk about new rules for driverless cars, what we can expect on the IP front in the Supreme Court's upcoming term, much more stuff to come. But we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law first, and that is Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared generally in 40 minutes or less. Save time and money. Shopping at the grocery store is 60% more expensive than Blue Apron. If you spend a lot eating out or at high-end grocery chains, you can now spend under $10 per person for healthy home-cooked meals. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences and choose a delivery option that fits your needs. There's no weekly commitment at all, so you only get deliveries when you want them. And Blue Apron delivers now to 99% of the continental U.S. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Seafood is sourced sustainably, beef is raised humanely, chickens are free range, pork is raised naturally, and regenerative farming practices are used for produce. By shipping the exact amount required for the recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron brings you the best. I've talked about showing you pictures of the Blue Apron meals that we make in our house, and I can personally stand by this product. I think it's a wonderful way to engage the entire family in the kitchen. I was reading something the other day on how schools aren't teaching life skills anymore, you know, basic financial management skills, basic how to prepare a meal for yourself skills. If they can't teach music or art, I suppose they can't teach those other things either, but they're very necessary skills. And Blue Apron is a great way to jumpstart the cooking piece in your own home, because the shopping is done. The decision about what to make is done. The step-by-step instructions making it easy to put together something that you feel like you've really accomplished something when you've prepared these meals. That's why it's fun to take pictures of them, because they come out beautifully and they're delicious. So I cannot recommend enough. Help your family know, you know, once they've left the nest, or if your spouse is just not the, you know, most proficient person in the kitchen, help them develop some life skills. And the other thing that I really, really love about it is how they put together recipes that, you know, as I'm strolling through the grocery store picking up our essentials, I don't think to myself that, hey, tonight we should have paprika spiced shrimp and cheddar grits with tomato and sweet corn. You know, if I were spending a lot of time poring over cookbooks, I might put together that great dish and then go down to the store and get all the ingredients. But, you know, I just don't spend that much time doing that. Eggplant and chickpea tagine with Islander pepper, tomato and couscous, summer udon noodle salad with cherry tomatoes, corn and summer sweet pepper, spicy hoisin chicken stir fry with baby bok choy and sesame ginger cucumber salad. I love how they bring together lots of different cultural influences, lots of tastes that, again, you might just not think to pull down off the shelf when you're picking up the milk. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Visit blueapron.com/twit. It's so wonderful that they support our network, and we hope you will support them. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law and the Twit Network. All right, let us talk about new rules for driverless cars. We have the Department of Transportation this week releasing its first rule book governing the manufacture and sale of self-driving cars. So those Tesla cars, the Google cars without steering wheels or foot pedals, those kinds of devices now not only are subject to all of the various state guidelines and regulations on building them, testing them, et cetera. We now have federal Department of Transportation guidelines as well that are designed to bring some order to the fact that all the states were kind of doing their own thing. I think this is a good thing. It will give us some unity. I hope it will give some, you know, that it strikes the right balance between safety and innovation. So it's a good thing that this has come out. Hopefully the states will be able to track along with what the Department of Transportation thinks is a good idea. And we'll see this industry grow with a little bit more cohesion. Emery, any thoughts on the specifics here?
No, I mean, I only got through the executive summary. I do want to dig through these rules this weekend, but I basically agree with you on all fronts. You know, the idea that I can't wait for this to happen. I cannot wait. So that's when, by the way, that's Denise, when I'll get to go up to the studio, is when I don't have to actually drive the commute myself. When my car can make that awful, awful commute for me and I can play Pokemon or something, I'll be happy. But I don't know. Yeah, it's a great first step. I was sort of wondering, Francie, as someone that is, you know, much more in this space, you know, technically than I am, do you think that the technical problems that are facing the high automation or highly automated vehicles front are bigger than the regulatory problems facing them, or what's going to be the biggest barrier to adoption of these technologies, in your opinion?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if I can I don't understand the regulatory issues well enough to be able to compare, you know, which is more challenging. But there are certainly interesting technical challenges, you know, including from a safety and security perspective. One is just with the security of cars in general. So I actually several years ago was involved with a team at UW and in collaboration with UC San Diego, studying the security of modern cars, which are, you know, dozens of networked computers that are connected to the internet through telematic systems. We found sort of that, you know, the security of these systems was lacking at the time, and that a remote attacker could access your vehicle and do things like slam on the brakes. So it was pretty scary. Since then, the automotive industry has taken these issues really seriously, and I think has made a lot of progress. And I think that is also something that is important for driverless cars as well, because you know, the less control you have by a person, the scarier it maybe is if the car is not doing what you expect. And those are kind of security issues related to just, you know, even cars as they exist today. One thing I find really interesting and potentially challenging with driverless cars is that they're making decisions based on all sorts of sensor input. And one thing I worry about is if you can trick the cars about things. Like one simple example is like if you put up a fake road sign or something like that and cause those cars to react in ways that that a human wouldn't, that a human might recognize that the situation is weird. Yeah.
Trolling on the streets just got so much more terrifying. Oh my God.
Yeah. So I don't know to what extent that kind of concern is reflected in the proposed rules. And I hope that these companies are thinking about these issues.
Yeah. You should write the terribly dystopian sci-fi novel that springs from that idea, Francie.
Dystopian futures are my job. So.
The other thing that, you know, we've been talking a lot about drone law recently on the show and new FAA rules governing the safe operation of commercial and hobby drones. And I think we're in kind of a similar situation here where the Department of Transportation had to come out with rules that recognizes safety considerations, but I don't think the lawmakers have gotten to the point of recognizing that when you climb into a self-driving car, you may be climbing into, bad pun ahead, an echo chamber where everything you're doing in the car is being monitored and tracked and recorded and everything else. I just think that the privacy piece, like with refrigerators, is probably not on enough people's radar. Do you agree, Francie?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Kind of all of the things we've been talking about today reflect the fact that computers are pervading every aspect of our lives, and there's this tension. There's all these great benefits that we can get from them, but there are also risks. And so, the sooner we can start thinking about them before these technologies become widespread, the better.
Right. California.
Virgil.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Virgil brought up in the chat that we didn't have this in the show notes, but yeah, you know, there was the article about Tesla responding to it, the Tesla S getting hacked from 10 miles away by some Chinese researchers. So, you know, Tesla is a company that has a very good track record for responding to, you know, cybersecurity issues with their cars. They are like much, I think that as far as I'm aware, they're the best company right now at like pushing out updates immediately. This is a company that has thought very much about this and still had issues with, you know, wirelessly being able to turn on the brakes from 10 miles away. So, yeah,
right.
You know, and actually just to piggyback on that, Francie, you said earlier that you have two Echos or an Echo in your house. And, you know, I am in a lot of ways in the same boat where like I consider myself, you know, a privacy advocate or at least someone that, you know, thinks a lot about these types of things, but I also love technology. And at the same time, you know, I am aware of these types of privacy problems and cybersecurity issues, but man, I am totally going to be the one to sign up for, you know, the driverless cars. I don't know where the question is in this, but it's like you see people sort of, poo-pooing the entire movement by saying like, oh, well, what are you going to do? Like, stop using electronics. But yeah, there is a cost benefit analysis that all of us are doing, even, you know, people that are very concerned about these things, that, you know, even us that are really concerned about these things are really useful. And in a lot of ways, they're probably we're not going to be able to make the choice not to live with them.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the reasons that we need to talk about these issues and figure out how to balance them, what people's mental models and expectations are, and try to build in, you know, transparency and control and other things. I agree with you. I don't think it's reasonable to say like, oh, you're worried about privacy, so stop using the internet. For a while that was kind of a thing. A few years ago, there was a lot of privacy concern about Facebook. And it was like, well, don't have a Facebook account. But that increasingly became kind of a social liability not to have. And it's not, I think one of the reasons that I care about improving these things is that that's just not a reasonable choice to ask of people. Mm-hmm. That's not an acceptable trade-off, like, you know, give up on privacy versus don't use anything in our modern society. That's just not reasonable. And I think we can do better.
Hear, hear.
Right. Hear, hear. I think we're going to make tricking driverless cars our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional and you need to make professional education credit requirements. So if you're a lawyer, we have some information for you at wiki.twit.tv. Yes. Oh, that's perfect. Victor in the studio just put up an animation of Wile E. Coyote, if you're not watching the video, painting a tunnel on a side of a cliff to trick you into driving into what is not actually a tunnel.
Yep, that's exactly what I was talking about.
Yes. Fast thinking.
You know, Victor. Or it could be bring up the AR discussion that we've been having over the past week, you know? You could just,
yes.
They wouldn't have to paint a thing on the wall. They could just drop an AR, you know, tunnel that right. doesn't exist.
If you're driving a Tesla, it would clearly just go through the way the Roadrunner does in the video.
Yeah.
No, not actually. So if you go to wiki.twit.tv and you find our This Week in Law page there and you're a lawyer, you're going to find information about applying for MCLE credit in your jurisdiction. If you'd like that, it is there for you. Emery, I just got word that you may need to duck out. Is that the case?
Yes.
Do you want to hang with us or should we let you go?
Yeah, I hate to say this, but I got to duck out. Got to put out some fires. But I really want to thank you for coming on the show, Francie. I am so I'm going to dig through your report. This is utterly fascinating stuff and honestly exactly the kind of thing that got me tuning into Twill originally. So thanks for coming on the show. And Denise, thanks for having me again.
Thank you so much for joining us. I hope your fires have nothing to do with exploding cell phones and see you next week.
All right.
Thanks, Emery. It was fun chatting.
Yep, absolutely. Take care. Bye.
All right. Let's see. Where shall we go next? I wanted to just point out something that people might not have thought about. This is something that actually found in Emery's Twitter stream, something that caught his attention and ergo caught mine. And it's just an unintended consequence. And this is a hypothesis, but I think it's a good one. This is a Reuters report, so I'm not sure. Let's see. It doesn't have an author on it, but it's a report from Reuters called Why the Supreme Court May Hear the Case of the Dancing Baby. And the author's theory here is that with an evenly divided court and eight-member Supreme Court, as opposed to its usual complement of nine, that it may decide to punt on the tougher, more sort of personal rights policy cases that we're used to seeing from the courts. And what it might decide to do, Mark Lemley, law professor at Stanford, in the article speculates, is take on more patent law, copyright, trademark kind of cases. They have very high stakes and important issues, but they're not the kind of partisan policy issues that the court might be more inclined to divide on. So the theory here is that we, you know, there are lots of IP cases that we've been following that may get to the court. The Slants Rock Band case is one of them. about whether they could get that trademark registered. The Redskins case, similar, is another one. There are lots of IP law cases that the court might decide to punt on under other circumstances, but this whole 8-person court thing could tip the balance into seeing more IP cases this year. So just something to toss out to you. Interesting theory from Mark Lemley reported there, and we'll just have to see if it plays out or not. Of course, October is right around the corner. Anything else in the rundown that really caught your eye, Francie, that you wanted to discuss before we go ahead and get to our concluding material of the show? I'm pretty much...
Yeah, actually, one of the things that Emery just mentioned, and I think I saw one of your older episodes that you talked about augmented reality and virtual reality, and I just wanted to chime in on that. I think that's a really interesting space that we're also looking at in our lab, specifically from the perspective of trying to anticipate where that technology is going and what the security and privacy challenges will be. So there's obviously the types of privacy challenges we've already been talking about on the show, including, you know, if you're wearing an augmented reality device, for it to be useful, it needs to be processing sensor input. And so there's a big privacy issue there, both for yourself and for other people around you. But one of the issues I'm really interested in is quite similar to the self-driving car one, as Emery pointed out, which is that as you are... if you're wearing an augmented reality device or you have an augmented reality windshield on your car, which is something that a lot of companies are working on, you might have, you know, buggy or malicious applications that are showing virtual content. That might be visual content, that's usually what we think of, but also audio content or haptic feedback. You know, thinking about it from the adversarial perspective, like we tend to do in our research, what a bad application can do when it is overlaying, you know, it is effectively modifying your perception of the world. That gets really scary fast, too.
Mm-hmm. There is one other thing in the rundown, and I want to talk to you more about your augmented reality research in just a moment. Since that's going to be one of our resources of the week. But before we get there, let us look at something from the world of robotics just to close out the show. The car rules, the Department of Transportation rules that we were discussing a moment ago, deal with safety. And so do now something from the British Standards Institute that deals with robotics, rules of good robot behavior. It's aimed at robots and robotic devices. And was discussed recently at the Social Robotics and AI Conference in Oxford, England. So it's the first published standard for the ethical design of robots that sort of plays off Isaac Asimov's original science fictional laws of good robot behavior and gives people some guidelines they can actually use, such as robots should not be designed solely or primarily to kill or harm humans. Humans, not robots, are the responsible agents. It should be possible to find out who is responsible for any robot and its behavior. So safety and ethics, I think, are all bound up in these particular rules, but I don't know that the rules that have been released for the development and testing of self-driving cars, for example, in the United States, really start to encompass those ethical kinds of considerations yet. And maybe they should. What do you think, Francie?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually a good example of just like looking through this list of topics that we've discussed today. We live in such a crazy time. These are all such futuristic topics that are really, really relevant right now, just this week. I agree with you. There are definitely similarities. You know, in some sense, self-driving cars are robots. I think this is a really challenging problem. Actually, one thing I would recommend to people interested in this topic is the book Superintelligence. If you haven't heard of it, it does a very good job of laying out why it will be difficult to specify rules that will end up working as we intend for robots to be good in some sense, whatever good means, defining that as part of what's hard. So if you have not heard of that book, I would recommend checking it out on this topic.
What's the title again?
It's called Superintelligence. Yes, that's it.
Superintelligence. Let's make superintelligence our second MCLAE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, just so it will further stick in people's brains. And yeah, that looks like a great one to add to my reading list. Francie, thank you for bringing it up. We're going to thank our final sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase or software installation. With their iOS or Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to US audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for making our lives easier, more convenient, professional, more privacy-friendly, and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, we're going to move on to, we've been discussing some fairly heady things this week, so we might need a little animal selfie chaser about now. Wonderful. So our animal selfie of the week comes from Japan, a place and a park in this place called Nara, if I'm pronouncing that properly, as my ad tech loads here in my browser page, I can tell you more about Nara. Here we go. It is situated in the west central section of Honshu, the largest island of Japan. Nara was the capital of Japan from 710 to 784. And it witnessed seven successive emperors over the Nara period. One thing that is very special and sacred in Nara is their deer. So it is not unusual for a visitor, as this Taiwanese young lady was doing, visiting Nara, to attempt to take a photo with the deer. However, the particular deer that she captured here was just not happy. She got just this wonderful moment of side eye from this Nara deer that basically seemed to telegraph the message, I have not assigned my rights of publicity and certainly have not assigned them to you. We, as you know, we feature these animal selfies every week because of the interesting dynamic of whether animals and or automated intelligences have various rights like rights of publicity and copyright. Some cases on that are wending their way through courts even as we speak. So our animal selfie this week is the really ticked off side-eye deer from Nara, Japan. We hope you have enjoyed this little interlude. We have some tips and resources of the week for you. Let's start with our resources, the first of which is University of Washington's Augmented Reality, Computer Security, and Privacy Research Lab, where Francie does research and work. Can you tell us more about this, Francie?
Yeah, so we have a our full lab is the Security and Privacy Research Lab, and this is one of the areas that we're working in. So as I mentioned earlier, we're really interested in trying to understand where these technologies are going to go. From a research perspective, what we often do is some of the work we do is studying existing ecosystems, like the tracking work we talked about earlier today. But some of the work we do tries to anticipate where technology is going, because there we really have an opportunity to improve security and privacy properties of technologies before they become widespread. In our discussion today, there's been some depressing moments where we realize everybody's already using the web, and it's not so easy to change. So augmented reality is both a really exciting area, just from a technological perspective, it's really cool, but also one where we might still be able to shape these technologies for the better. So we've been working for a few years now and still working on trying to understand what the new security and privacy challenges will be, and how to design these platforms in ways that that are secure and safe and private.
So can you tell us any of the specifics that you're looking at the Augmented Reality Computer Security and Privacy Lab?
Yeah, so for example, one of the problems we're really interested in, I alluded to it earlier, is the fact that you will, suppose you're wearing an augmented reality headset and you've downloaded some applications from the App Store, and those applications are modifying your view of the world. They're showing virtual three-dimensional content, like I might have my virtual cat over there. I might have, something that's recognizing and labeling faces. I might have my Pokemon game. I might have all sorts of things. And with one of the questions we're thinking about is what happens when the things those applications are trying to display conflict with each other, and what happens if those applications are malicious. Going back to the driving scenario, if you have a car with an augmented reality windshield, it's pretty clear what the safety implications are. If you have applications that are start popping up ads everywhere while you're driving, or block or modify road signs, or prevent you from seeing pedestrians, those are all the types of things that seriously dangerous physical world implications. And so the questions we're thinking about are, how do we design these platforms, essentially the operating systems for augmented reality platforms, to prevent these types of bad cases from happening?
And are you looking at existing platforms and poking at them and seeing how insecure or hackable they are?
We are a bit, although it's still very early for many of these technologies. We're mostly just trying to get a sense of how they work and what their capabilities are. I would say we are thinking about kind of what these future technologies will be like. Often today, they're limited in ways that make these problems not so bad. Like, they can only run one application at a time, really. And that kind of limits the degree of conflict you might have between applications and so on. So it's an interesting space to be working in, because the technology isn't quite there. So we have to do a little bit of projecting of where it will go.
Right. I wonder if there is a crossover between the paper that you all just published and these technologies as well, how ad tech and tracking is going to port over to the worlds of augmented and virtual reality. I'm sure it will, one way or another, but it's hard to envision how it,
I'm sure we'll be seeing, instead of physical billboards, we'll be seeing virtual billboards that will have personalized ads for you and so on. So I'm sure it will be an extension of this ecosystem.
Right. Well, very interesting. We'll continue to follow along with your work there. Another resource I wanted to highlight for folks, if you enjoy listening to this law-related show, you might also like to know that the University of California, Irvine, which is just up the street from me here, it has a fairly young law school. I think it's 5 or 6 years old. Its dean happens to be one of the preeminent constitutional scholars in our country. His name's Erwin Chemerinsky, and they have a podcast. It's called UCI Law Talks. Scrolling through, I recognize Rick Hasen as someone I'm familiar with. One of our former and hopefully future TWIL guests has become a professor at UCI. So good place to look out for issues that you might see coming to the Supreme Court in this or future terms, since we're looking for more IP law stuff there. And just in general, if you're interested in what the big issues are, this would be a good show to follow along with. I wanted to mention in passing, too, since we're talking about UCI, UCI was just written up in Business Insider this week as one of the few schools around the country. We've highlighted a few others on the show that is offering an esports scholarship. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, also they have a major a program in computer science up your alley, Francie, computer science and gaming. So it looks like UCI is really doubling down on gaming tech, both on the sports and entertainment front by having a pretty tricked out esports arena and offering scholarship for esports players, and also teaching people how they can build those technologies as well. One final resource for you to look at is something with a deadline coming up that you may be interested in. It is called Tech Congress. And what they are doing is they are granting fellowships to individuals who might very well be in our audience right now. People who are interested in technology, familiar with technology, at least have a passing interest in policy and law, but not necessarily an expert in any of those things. These fellowships are designed to let people work with members of Congress or congressional committees and help them understand the technological policy issues that they're grappling with. They have an application deadline for these fellowships coming up on September 30th. So if you are interested, we have the link in the discussion points, and their main site is techcongress.io. It's a really nice looking fellowship that involves an actual salary of $70,000 a year, a stipend, reimbursements for relocation and travel, that kind of thing. So if this is at all interesting to you, or you know someone who might be a good fit for this position, you can also nominate them. So take a look at it. Certainly the cause of having Congress people and senators understand the technology that they are legislating about is a really good one. So if you can help out in that regard, I encourage you to do so. Our tips of the week, we have several for you again this week. The first one is super useful. It's a really long list. It's from Consumer Reports, and it's 66 ways to protect your privacy right now. The way I suggest tackling this is maybe, you know, give yourself a couple of months and tick off one a day. Various just easy tips to look at, things like check whether your email address has ever been involved in a known data breach, how you would do that, how you can limit Wi-Fi imposters, see who shared your private data, that kind of thing. 66 of those kinds of things. What very practical tip, what sort of actual real world documents should you shred? Do you need to shred everything that you've left behind? No, of course not. But what should you shred? Really nice, practical tips from Consumer Reports. So I hope you'll check those out. Let's see. Next tip of the week. So what you want to do is follow all those 66 tips. What you don't want to do is do what this Twitch streamer did, which was stream live for several nights that he was going to go alone into Central Park at night to play Pokemon Go and stream himself doing it. This was Twitch user RickyBot, who, there's no telling whether the person who decided to mug him and take his phone in Central Park at night when he was alone had been watching his stream and knew right where to go to find him. But that certainly could have been the case. So if you are going to stream your activity, please, as They write it up rocks. Be aware of your surroundings. Are you waving your fancy new phone around in a place where you probably shouldn't be? Are you about to walk off a dang cliff? Keep your senses intact because your Pokemon aren't going to save you if you get in trouble. This kind of cracked me up because last month when I was in New York, we were at a park, actually a plaza, a square, right next to Central Park, right in front of the Plaza Hotel. I think we have a picture of it. Victor, if you can pop it up there, it's right below the Uproxx story. It is this lovely plaza that was just packed with people. There it is. It's got a picture of General Sherman on a horse in the middle of it. And as in this picture, it was even more packed when we were there. That Central Park behind with all the greenery. And everyone in this plaza was playing Pokemon Go when we were there. And the crazy thing that happened when we were there catching our various Pokemon was someone rode up on a bike and had a Pokemon-shaped backpack on their back. And what seemed to be, I mean, my guess is they were promoing some sort of Pokemon tracking app because the person announced loudly that a Snorlax had been seen a few blocks away. And it just was terrifying and comical to watch a bunch of people following him off into goodness knows where in New York in search of the Snorlax. At least it was broad daylight. So once again, don't stream your location late at night. And I would go so far as to don't follow the random guy who shows up at the plaza and tells you there's a Snorlax nearby, especially if he appears to be promoting some kind of app. The other tip of the week I wanted to mention, this was something that you tweeted, Francie, that was a photograph of a Jeopardy question, something you retweeted, I think, from Steve Vladek. And the Jeopardy question was asking somebody to identify. The answer to the question would have been, what is FISA, the special court set up to approve national security warrants? Unfortunately, I don't think anybody on the show knew the answer to the question. Is that your take? Is that what you got from it as well?
Oh, I don't know. Actually, I was just, my reaction to it was that, you know, just a few years ago, everybody was saying, oh, privacy is dead. If you have nothing to hide, why are you worried? And so on. And I feel like in the last couple of years, in part due to, you know, national security disclosures, in part due to, you know, increased privacy issues and increased, you know, some of the IoT devices we've been talking about. I feel like privacy is dead is no longer the thing I'm hearing, and people are actually concerned about privacy. And so I felt like this was a great example of how it's come much more into our popular discourse to actually be concerned about these issues.
That's right. So our tip of the week cobbled together from that is that Scott McNeely, when he said, you have no privacy anyway, get over it, may have been wrong. At least people may want to fight back and reassert some privacy that Scott McNeely famously said they didn't have. So interesting societal indicator whether people on Jeopardy would certainly expected that someone might know who FISA was, but I think as you read through the comments, they said no, sadly no one knew the answer. So maybe we
okay, I didn't see that part. That's true.
Yeah. Maybe we have further to go. At any rate, we don't have any further to go with this episode of This Week in Law. We are done. We have had a really, really wonderful time with Francie Rosner. We've talked about a lot of what you've been up to at University of Washington, both in the Privacy Research Lab and with the paper you published. Is there anything else that you want to let people know about with your work before we close out the show?
No, we've actually covered quite a lot of it. I really appreciate you having me on the show. I really had a lot of fun.
I think it would be just fascinating to take one of your classes. You're teaching undergraduate classes, right?
Yeah, I teach both undergraduate and graduate computer security and privacy courses.
That's great. So anybody with kids heading up to University of Washington, definitely head them toward Professor Rosner's classes. Big thanks to my co-hosts, Mike Keyes and Emery Roan, for joining us today. Big thanks to all of you. You should and can get in touch with us between the shows. You can email Mike, Emery, and me at our first names at twit.tv. Denise at twit.tv, Emery at twit.tv, Mike at twit.tv. We'll get to all of us respectively. You can find us on Twitter. That's a great way to get in touch. The show has both Facebook and Google Plus pages. Other wonderful ways to let us know what's on your mind, further thoughts that you had in response to things that we discussed today or things that you'd like to see us discuss in the future, guests you'd like to see us invite on. We love it all. Send it all our way. Enjoy hearing from you. Very, very much. In fact, can't really do the show without it. It's so helpful and useful as we're prepping to know what you're interested in and paying attention to, because we can't be everywhere at once. No one can. So glad that you've been able to join us. We record the show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC every Friday. If you go to twit.tv/live, that's where you can join us live. Or if you head over to twit.tv/twill, that's where our whole archive of shows will be. And this episode will be as soon as it is edited and posted, which will be in just the next couple of days here. So so glad you could join us, Francie. It's been a real pleasure meeting you. Thank you for all of your hard work and your interesting study and great thoughts today. And hopefully we'll get you back on the show before too long.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you so much, Denise.
All right. Take care.
You too.
All right. Bye, everyone. Thanks for joining us on This Week in Law.